Doom do 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 do. Hi, plant friends. Welcome to episode 96 of
Blue and Grow Radio.
Plant friends, today is a super nerdy one. I'm serving you two super nerdy episodes back to back with last week's episode on drainage and this week's episode on garden bugs, insects, pests with Nadia of Urban Farm Sister. I hope this content is lighting you up as much as it's lighting me up. It's so fun to dive deep these days. And as always, if you have particular episode topics that you want to hear about, slide into my DMs on Instagram and let me know. I'm always sourcing potential topics for the show. So I'm so thrilled to welcome Nadia from Urban Farm Sister today to talk all things bugs. She's the bug lady. She is actually the plant lady behind several amazing businesses and planty projects, including the Urban Farm Sister educational social media platforms, Kiwi Produce, and Agri Academy, which we will hear more about in our conversation. She graduated from Ohio State with a bachelor's degree in agriculture, and she minored in entomology, which is bugs, plant friends, and we dive deep. This is a longer episode, but it's because she just gives so much interesting information on insects, why they're in our gardens, and how to care for them. And I really appreciate that in our conversation, she really encourages us to kind of zoom out and think of the garden as like a larger ecosystem and think about the why behind these bugs and insects are showing up and not just, darn it, I have this beetle, how do I get rid of it? I thought it was a really interesting conversation. And that practice of zooming out is really helpful in the garden with our plants and also with our lives, plant friends, especially in these times. I'm finding zooming out and getting perspective just on my life on the whole these days has been really helpful. So I'm happy to have done that with Nadia on this smaller scale with bugs as well. So I'm going to leave the intro there because our conversation is long and we got to get to it, plant friends. Before we dive in, I just wanted to let you know that we are releasing so many fun videos on the Bloom and Grow YouTube show. So I hope that you have hopped over there, checked out some of the videos, that you're sharing them with your friends, and that you're subscribed. Last week, we released the entire month-long process to planning and planting my balcony garden. It was a really fun video to put together for you guys, and I hope you head over to the YouTube show and check it out and let me know what you want to see more of. Special thanks to our newest Patreon plant friends, Lily and Jamie Gray. Thank you so much for joining our community and pledging to contribute to keep Bloom and Grow on the airwaves on a monthly basis. If you, plant friends, might be interested in supporting Bloom and Grow in a monetary way for just about the price of a cup of coffee a month, you can click the link in the show notes to learn more. I don't know about you, plant friends, but it's been an interesting few weeks. I've got a lot of change happening in my life that you'll learn about in a few weeks. And I am just going back to plants. You know, they announced that Broadway, my other career, will not be opening back up until 2021. And there's a lot of change afoot. And I'm just thinking about plants and their processes and dormancy and pruning. And I'm trying to really practice what I preach with using plants to help get me through a very interesting time in my life. And I hope that you guys are doing that as well. And I have a plant side chat coming your way that I hope will be very helpful because it's been very helpful to me. All right, short and sweet intros today, plant friends, because we got to get to this amazing conversation. So before we talk to Nadia, a plant lady who I am thankful for, I want to tell you about our first episode sponsor of the day, who I am very thankful for, MakeSpace. Plant friends, MakeSpace makes storage simple, seamless, and affordable without you ever having to leave your apartment. Yes, that's right. You heard me. MakeSpace will come pick up your stuff and store it for you without ever having to deal with schlepping to a sketchy storage facility ever again. Plant friends, this is a genius business. Here's how it works. They ship you reusable bags that fit into their boxes ahead of time for free. You pack the bags up at your leisure, and then they send their movers to come pick up your stuff and haul it to their secure storage facilities. You live your life, and whenever you need that stuff back, they will deliver it back to you at your current or new home. And you can schedule everything, your pickups, your deliveries, with their easy-to-use app and use their complete digital photo inventory of all of your stuff. It is such a smart company that is helping so many people in cities across the country. I actually used MakeSpace when I moved in with Billy, and it was an amazing experience. I basically had 2 months in between when I had to move out of my apartment and into the new apartment with Billy. So I used MakeSpace for that 2 month time gap. They came, they picked up all my stuff. I didn't lift a finger for the whole move. They stored it and then they delivered it to my new apartment, which was a fourth floor walk-up plant, friends. And they made it the easiest move of my life. It was an amazing experience. Now, we have never spent more time indoors than in the midst of everything happening in the world today. So whether you need to make space for a new home office, maybe a nursery, maybe you're swapping out seasonal clothing, or maybe you're moving, or maybe, plant friends, you got to make more space for more plants. Build your urban jungles by making more space. MakeSpace has customizable fixed monthly rates for you because with MakeSpace, you only pay for the space that you need. And MakeSpace is offering Bloom and Grow Radio listeners $100 off with the code SPACEPLZ at checkout. So if you want to make space in your home, visit makespace.com to see their different sizing options and use the code SPACEPLZ. That's SPACEPLZ for $100 off. Do you have upcoming travel to a different country scheduled, or maybe you have a relative or a friend who speaks a different language that you want to connect with on a deeper level? Why not easily learn a new language with my favorite language learning tool, Rosetta Stone? I recently went to Italy and I brushed up on my Italian by using the Rosetta Stone app for like 20 minutes every morning. It was so easy to use. It was part of my morning practice. It was really fun. And let me tell you, Rosetta Stone works. It brushed me up so good. I was getting around Italy easily speaking Italian after putting those reps in. If you don't already know, Rosetta Stone is the trusted language learning tool available on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone has 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered. It makes language learning so fun, so easy, and so fast. It immerses you in the language, which is the fastest way to learn. So it's an intuitive process with no English translation, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in the language. It even coaches you on pronunciation with its true accent feature, which is like basically having a physical trainer for your accent. It's so wild. The desktop and app options make it so easy to do consistently, and it's an amazing value. Lifetime membership has all 25 languages forever for any and all trips and language needs in your entire life. So this year I brushed up on my Italian, but next year Billy and I want to go to Japan so we could learn conversational Japanese with it. That's lifetime access to 25 language courses Rosetta Stone has to offer, and right now they're offering 50% off. It's an insane steal. So don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Growing Joy with Plants listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life, plant friends. It's an insane deal. Redeem 50% off at Rosetta, R-O-S-E-T-T-A, stone.com/today. Okay, here's Nadia. Nadia, welcome to the Bloom and Grow Radio podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
I'm so excited to have you answer all of the questions that listeners send me that I don't know how to answer because I am so out of my element with garden pests.
I just love the insects. So I'm excited about doing this podcast and educating about entomology as well as how to effectively control certain insects in the garden.
Now, you have a degree in entomology, right?
Yes, I do. I have a master's of science from the University of Nebraska entomology. My focus when I was actually there was medical entomology. I've always been interested in insects and arthropods that cause disease. Mm. But I found that people know pretty much nothing about any insects or arthropods. So using that knowledge, I started social media accounts and things, and I started educating people about all types of insects and arthropods beyond just the ones that are like mosquitoes and ticks and things like that. And I found that people were very, very interested in learning. I didn't think people were. I thought I was just, you know, just this anomaly that wasn't interested in insects and things. But when people are out farming or gardening or insects coming to their houses and things, they wanted to know how to control them or how to prevent them. And so that's where my social media kind of started, with teaching about insects, but also teaching about farming and gardening and things like that.
What is an arthropod?
So an arthropod is a class I'm sorry, a phylum, organisms that they do not have a internal skeletal system. Their skeletal system is actually on the outside. It's called an exoskeleton.
Okay.
So things that fall under arthropods are insects, arachnids, which are spiders, ticks, mites, centipedes, millipedes, things like crustaceans. All of those would fall under arthropod, and they all share similar characteristics as far as, you know, the exoskeleton. They have what are called chelicera, which are mouth parts.
Okay.
But then once you break off into the different classes, like class Insecta, class Arachnida, then they have specialized characteristics that categorize them into those classes.
Okay. So an arthropod is like a classification, basically, that all most bugs fall under. Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, I love it. We're off to the races with definitions. Before we dive into all things arthropods, tell us a little bit about how you became the epic CEO, founder, plant bug lady that you are today. How did you become the founder of Kiwi Produce Agri Academy and the Urban Farm Sista brand?
Well, it all started when I was a young child. I've always had an interest in animals. I was really drawn to insects, though. I just have always liked them from a young child, like 4 years old. I would just be catching insects. And at that time, there was no internet or anything back then. So I would check out books from like the libraries and things, and I would study the books, and then I would go out and catch things and watch the insects for like hours just in the little jars I had and see how they interacted with each other and things like that. And my great grandmother, she actually, you know, honed in on my love for insects. So anytime I would go over to her house, she would always have a jar full of all these different arthropods. And at 4 years old, I was educating her on, you know, you can't put spiders and ants together, and you can't put this sand in there, and all these different things. And so at four, I was pretty much an entomologist then. And wow. She really like helped build that love. And so she's passed away since then. But everything I do it because of her. Like, she would sit there and listen to me explain about these insects for hours. And like, I would sit there and she'd be, what did I catch you this time? And, you know, I would explain what was in the jar. So as I got older and went into higher levels of school, when I got to high school, I really became interested in zoonotic diseases, diseases that are transmitted by animals, and more particular arthropod-borne diseases, things like, you know, like Lyme disease and West Nile and Chagas disease and African sleeping sickness. They were all transmitted either by an insect or an arthropod,
wow.
Like a tick or things like that. And so I was really interested in that when I was in high school. I remember that's when the internet first came out, and I found this guy. I forget what it might have been, the USDA website, and it was talking about all these different zoonotic diseases, and they had a whole section on arthropod-borne diseases. And I printed out that whole guide, like it was about 300 pages, and I was just like so excited, like I didn't even know this was like out here and like all this. And so that like sparked my interest. And I was also interested in veterinary medicine. I've always wanted to be a veterinarian. And so when I went to college, I initially started at one college and then transferred to another. But I was first biology. And then when I transferred to the other college, I became agriculture and I became animal science major. Okay. But I also minored in pre-veterinary medicine and I minored in entomology. And then that's when I graduated. But when I was in undergrad, I got sick with a thyroid condition and I failed some classes and things because I just couldn't go and they wouldn't allow me to drop them. And so that dropped my GPA. So that kind of put my veterinary dreams on hold. I'm still going to pursue it. It's just like now, though, you know, I'm doing all this other stuff now. But that was like the start of it. So after I graduated from undergrad, I actually worked in veterinary medicine for about 15 years. I was working in research. And so I worked in laboratory animal research. I worked in veterinary research. I got a job at the Ohio Department of Agriculture, and I transferred to all these different departments that they have in their animal industry. So I was learning about bacteriology, virology, serology. So I was really interested. I don't know. I've always just like learning about diseases and how they transmit in animal. Most of our diseases come from animals, like whether we're consuming them or, you know, somehow we're exposed to them. A lot of our diseases that we get that are infectious come from things outside. And so that was very interesting to me. And so I had a job there, and then I actually got a job at the University of Georgia. So I moved down to Georgia and I was working at a wildlife disease, and I would, you know, study. I wasn't studying. I was actually testing all the southeastern states for prions for deer. It's a prion called chronic Equation disease. And so I would get 10,000 like brain specimens in and stuff, and I would have to test them to see if they actually had this prion disease. And if they did, then the DNR in that area would have to go in and like pretty much eradicate all the deer in that area, because this disease was so infectious that you didn't want that out there because it could wipe out a whole population.
Wow.
Yeah. So after that, then I moved back to Ohio. And then I was working in an oncology lab at the Ohio State University. And what really triggered me to start this whole agriculture, farming, you know, self-sustainable adventure that I'm doing now, I was working in that oncology lab and seeing these animals come in, and they had cancer. And then their owners also had cancer. So that, you know, the pets would go to radiation and get their chemotherapy at the hospital. And then like same time that week, their owners were going and getting their treatment. I was like, why is animals and the people, why are we all getting this cancer? And then I started thinking like, you know what, we're all eating the same thing. Mm. All our food comes from the same sources, whether it's dog food or cat food or human, they're using the same ingredients and they're all coming from the same farms. And that's probably the source of where a lot of these cancers and things are coming from. And so that's what started me to think like, okay, well, how can I remove myself from this? And that's when I started a little garden. And then the following year, I purchased this empty lot and I turned it into an urban farm. And then from there, that's where I would take pictures of insects and try to educate on how to control them. Some of these are important, and some of the things that we're doing are actually attracting them. And this is the way you can go about controlling them without destroying everything in the environment. And so after I started that urban farm, which was Kiwi Produce, that was the company it's called. Mm-hmm. And I would sell the produce that I was growing. And then I would also offer classes and teach people how to grow in soil as well as hydroponics. And I was really like pushing for people that lived in like apartments and things to learn how to grow their own food and hydroponics indoors, so they too could be part of providing for themselves, becoming self-sustainable, even if you are living in a small environment. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I realized that I'm a Black woman, that working in veterinary medicine, working at all these different positions that I had, that there were not a lot of people that look like me in these positions. Mm. And so that really pushed me to want to educate about agriculture as an option for Black people, people of color, and things like that. And so I created AgriCademy just for that. It was part of its research. I do a lot of research because it's in me. I'm a scientist. I'm a nerd. So I'm always trying to research, you know, ways to improve upon things. My focus is like biotechnology and not necessarily trying to make GMOs, but trying to use, you know, natural selection and things to improve the plants that we have now. Because the reason they created GMOs, a lot of these GMOs, is because of the pests and things were ravaging through these crops. It's because they had insects, they can mutate their DNA and become very resistant to a lot of the pesticides and things that are out here now very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so the only way you can combat that is you have to have plants that can either are strong enough to take the attack, or you have to create plants that are resistant. So they created GMO plants with the premise that if we put things in there that would, you know, kill insects, that it would help with the farming industry. Well, it was working to an extent, but now insects are becoming resistant even to the GMO crops. And so my thing with biotechnology is to look at, okay, there's cultivars of plants that are resistant to certain insects. Why are they resistant to those certain insects? Without putting in a bacterial DNA, how did this plant become resistant? Like, what in this environment allowed it to get to this point? Is this something that we should be growing in our lot since we're dealing with these particular insects and things? So that's why I do the research, as well as entomological research, is try to focus on controlling insects, but not eradicating them, like trying to show people that we can all live together in harmony without causing damage to the environment and damage to other creatures and things. I always try to tell people, I don't like calling them pests. I don't like that, because they're just doing what they do naturally. We have just created a scenario that they like. And so maybe if we don't create such an inviting environment, then they won't come along. And so I try to teach that, like, so this is what you did, and this is why they came, and this is right. Why they're getting out of control, because you don't have these other things here to combat them.
Well, that's very interesting, because we think about, oh, the pests are here, they're such a nuisance to me, how do I get rid of them? But in reality, we are the visitors in the ecosystem that we're
exactly
messing with. And so that's a very interesting perspective flip of being like, how can we better set up our gardens, our natural spaces to accommodate the right amount of bugs or pests, you know, the right amount of plants and pests and humans and all of it together, you know?
Exactly. And then you also have to look at your plants too. Okay, like say you're growing like a squash plant and you have insects that are attacking the leaves. If the damage is not like detrimental to the plant, sometimes you can allow a little damage because we're not going to consume the leaves anyway. We're only going to eat the fruit. So mm-hmm. we have to like change our mindset of like, yes, insects can be in our gardens, or, you know, arthropods can be there. They need to be there because there's certain ones that actually need to be there to help you help the ecosystem and the environment. So we have to look at, okay, what is being damaged on the plant? Is this a young plant? If it's young, is it being wiped out? Or, you know, if it's just a caterpillar chewing on one leaf, but it has like 30 other leaves, like, is this really something bad? Now, if it's like a collard plant, we eat the leaves and it's being ravaged by caterpillars, then yes, there's something you're going to have to come in and you're going to have to do something to control those insects because they are out of control at this point. They're eating up your whole crop. But if it's a plant that we don't really consume the leaves and nothing's bothering the actual fruit that we're going to consume, and it doesn't seem to be causing any grief as far as growing things, then maybe we can allow that. Or maybe we could plant a plant and, you know, relocate these insects onto that plant that they like. Because there's certain insects, you know, everybody loves butterflies, but they hate caterpillars. And caterpillars, some of them are very host specific. So if you have like particular plant and that's their host plant, those female butterflies are going to lay their eggs on that plant and they're going to eat it. And then their larvae are going to go through their life stages and then they'll pupate or whatever. And then they'll emerge as another butterfly. But we don't like that stage of their life where they're actually feeding on leaves and things. And so it's looking at what's being fed on and can I tolerate this? Can the plant tolerate this? Mm. It's just like a mindset thing that we have to change. And so that's what I was trying to do when it came to Agri Academy, trying to go back to all the stuff that I do. With Agri Academy, I created that to teach about the agriculture industry, not just farming, all these different things that are incorporated under agriculture, and try to teach it to Black children as well as other children of color, because there is a need for that diversity within this industry. And I know everybody's not going to want to be a farmer. Everybody can't farm. Everybody can't grow plants. No matter how many classes they take, it's just not in them. But there's other things in agriculture they could get involved in. Like, say, if they are trying to set up a farm, we need marketers, we need engineers, we need people to process seeds.
Yeah.
Bookkeepers, we need lawyers, we need doctors, we need veterinarians, we need nurses. So there's all types of things that fall under agriculture that a lot of people didn't even know was under that umbrella. And so I would go to the schools and it would be kind of like a career exploration type presentation. So say like one day we were talking about, I was showing the children, you know, they eat corn every day, corn's in everything, but they didn't know that the corn, they put corn almost in everything, whether it's in the high fructose corn syrup or if they're using it as like a filler or something. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't realize, like here in Ohio, corn is one of our top crops that is grown here. And I taught them about the corn. I taught them about how to grow it. I taught them about the different types of corn. Then I taught them about like different careers that you can have in the corn industry and how much money that industry brings into the United States every year with imports, exports, product development, and things like that. And that, you know, they didn't even know all of this. And so teaching them about things that they use and do every day, they got to see that science, agriculture is around them all the time, whether it's the food they eat, the clothes they wear, the gasoline in their parents' car, the construction materials, all of that falls under agriculture. And all of that has jobs or possible business opportunities that somebody can develop, even in these low income neighborhoods and things. And so that's what I would do at Agri Academy. I would go around and I would teach that to the youth. And then I also do things for the adults as well. And then I use social media to teach those same things. So that's how I became Agri Academy Kiwi Produce. And then now I'm doing this Agri Academy Lab where we're offering laboratory services. And we're really getting into this whole hemp thing now. And so we're going to start cultivating hemp and trying to better those genetics and things as well. Since it's pretty much a new crop here in the United States because it hasn't been grown at all.
Yeah, if you want to talk about job opportunities, gosh,
yes,
that's where the future yes. is, hemp and cannabis for sure.
Yes. But I want to teach people beyond just the CBD or smoking it and things like that. Because with hemp, there's thousands of uses for that plant. Mm-hmm. We had this toilet paper shortage with the COVID-19. You could take hemp and you can make toilet paper, other paper products, or you could take the hemp and make hempcrete, which is like concrete that's supposed to even be better than the concrete that we have now. So it goes beyond just what mainstream media is. All you ever hear about is CBD and you hear about smokable flowers. Mm-hmm. But it's that plant, they're not doing it any justice by just marketing those two things. There's so many other industries that a person can enter into, but you have to know about them. Another big area is hemp plastics, trying to get rid of all this plastic that we have right now in the environment. Hemp plastic will break down, depending on the formulation, it'll break down in 87 days once you put it in the right environment to decompose. And so that could be industry that these youth could actually pursue, make a lot of money for their family, but also help fix the environment. And so that's what I would do at Agri Academy. I would just go in and I would just present different things. I had a veterinarian. It's a black lady here. That's like my second mother. I had her come in and she taught about veterinary medicine. And every time I would go to the schools, I would have the lab coats for the children to wear. So they would wear lab coats. So they put them in the mindset of being a scientist or being a doctor that day or whatever. And so the day she came, they learned about being a veterinarian, and she had brought two little dogs in and they got to actually do an examination and use a stethoscope and do an exam. And so it was like, I didn't even know I could do this. So now I have children that want to be vets. They want to be entomologists. They want to be farmers, all types of things that had I not gone in and taught them that, they would have never known those were options. And so it just opens up a new world for them.
That's amazing. Well, I can't wait to hear more about Agri Academy and how all of the amazing things you're doing with it and how we can get involved later. And it just sounds like you're so rooted in education and everything, you know, you're doing. I'm so tired just thinking about all the things you do. But you're so rooted in education. And I think that that's really where it's at. I mean, that's the mission with Bloom and Grow too, because I think especially with our generation and the generations below us, people are so disconnected to the food that they eat. I mean, myself included, like before my eggplant plant that I grew this year, I didn't know that eggplant flowers were purple. I had never seen one before.
Okay.
To not understand those simple things, or, you know, offline, you and I were talking about watermelon, which is like the most delicious summer treat, and learning how to grow a watermelon and how freaking tricky it can be, which is something we grow with my mom every summer. But like, it's really tricky and a lot of animals that you have to kind of figure out how to avoid. And the vine is going to potentially choke your garden out and all these things.
Yes.
But we're just so used to picking it up in the grocery store that so many people are so disconnected with food. And I think it's going to be really important to kind of bridge those gaps. And I think Corona has been really interesting because so many people are trying gardening for the first time. And yes. Yes. I think that's a really exciting experience. And I also think it can be kind of a scary experience because we all know the first time, your first garden, like there's so much you don't know. I mean, I'm on my third year of my little balcony garden and there's still so much I don't know. And I think there's so much fear around pests, quote unquote pests. Mm-hmm. I know that you said we don't like talk, but bug infestations and diseases that your plants get. So especially with your first garden, and I know we have so many people listening where this is probably their first try at a, whatever we're calling them, victory gardens. I know we're not calling them victory gardens anymore, but the surge of people trying to grow their own food, which I think is amazing.
Yes.
So why don't we talk a little bit about the relationship between pests and plants? And one of the listener questions was, how do I differentiate a good pest and a bad pest if it's just sitting on the plant as part of the ecosystem or if it's harming the plant? So what is the kind of role between plants and pests in a general kind of biodiverse garden or forest or wherever?
Okay, so a lot of times, a lot of plants are used by insects and other arthropods as hosts for their young.
Okay.
Butterflies, they'll lay their eggs on certain plants and they'll hatch and the caterpillar comes out and it feeds. But plants themselves have created what are called host plant defenses. So you see plants and they're creating like toxins and they have thorns and hairs and all types of stuff. They've evolved into that plant to protect themselves from herbivore attacks, whether it be insects as well as, you know, herbivore, like larger animals. So plants are well equipped at protecting themselves from insects. But what happens is that we create these artificial environments where we might have a plant and we don't have any other plants. We just have that one plant there. Sometimes we create these monocultures where you only have that one plant. So if it's a host plant for a particular, say, butterfly or beetle or something, what happens is that they all come in, but you don't have any other plants there. So then you're not attracting the insects and other arthropods that may actually feed on this and keep that population in check. And so what happens is that they just ravage through it. And okay, so a lot of times...
Oh, I was just going to say, so most of us who have gardens that are handmade, obviously.
Yes.
If we are not setting our gardens up with a lot of biodiversity and a lot of different plants, we could be kind of disrupting that food system of like this bug lays its eggs on this plant, but then there's another bug that eats that bug, and then there's a bug that eats that bug, and then there's a bird that eats that bug. And
exactly.
So if we don't have the right amount of, I guess,
biodiversity.
The right amount of biodiversity, then that's going to set us up for these pest issues, which makes sense because we have them in our gardens that we make and plant up on our own.
Exactly. And also what happens too is when they start their garden, they'll go to a nursery, they'll go to some place where the plants are already started and not realize that a lot of times those plants are infested with insects and arthropods already. And then they bring those back home and then they introduce those insects and arthropods into their environment. So they may not have been there, but once you introduce that plant there and they're able to mature, if it stays caterpillars or beetle larvae and they mature and turn into adults, all they do is mate again, lay eggs, and then now you've created a whole ecosystem with all these new insects that were not there before. So I always tell people when they go and buy things from the store, especially if they're buying started plants, is that you want to quarantine those plants and treat them before you put them out anywhere. A lot of times too, people will grow something outside and then they'll bring it in during the wintertime if it's something that can survive the second season or whatever. Mm-hmm. And what happens when it's outside is that it becomes infested with all types of insect life, arthropods, sometimes even animals and things, and they bring that stuff in their house. And if they have like house plants and things, what happens is the insects don't care. They see plants. They can smell plants. They can smell and see and sense and know where things are that we can't see. So if you bring, say you brought a tomato plant in because you had it in a pot and you wanted to try to save it for next year, and it had soil insects, there was insects on the leaves, on the stems and things, and you had house plants, 9 times out of 10, they're going to find your house plants and then you're going to have that infestation. And that's the first thing new gardeners experience. Like, what did this come from? Like, how did these get in my house? And so, the first thing I ask them is like, did you have some plants outside and then you brought them back in the house? And that's the first indication that that's where that infestation probably came from.
What do you suggest for a quarantine number in terms of bringing a plant home from the nursery? How long should I quarantine it before I plant it in the ground? And then also bringing a plant indoors?
I would say at least a week to 10 days.
Okay.
When you bring it home, I would spray it. I recommend people either use neem oil or some type of essential oil, Castile soap and water spray, and spray down the plant, but also inspect the plant. If you see, like, if you see eggs or anything, either remove the eggs or remove the leaf that the eggs are on.
And what do eggs normally look like?
It totally depends on the insect or the arthropod. They can be very, very tiny. Some of them can be hard to see with the naked eye. Things like squash bugs, they lay their eggs in like a little formation and they're like brown and they'll be on the back of the leaf.
Okay.
But it totally depends on the insect. All eggs look different. So caterpillar eggs look different. They're different orientation depending on the species, beetles, all types of things. So you would have to, I tell people, if you don't know, you can like, I get questions all the time. You can ask somebody that knows, like, so try to befriend an entomologist or people send me pictures and they asked me stuff right before I was about to do this podcast. Somebody sent me a picture of what looks like a robber fly, but they think it's a wasp. But I'm about to explain to them why it's a robber fly, not a wasp. But I get pictures all the time. I get questions all the time. Like, they'll find like what they think might be an egg and I'll tell them, no, that's not an egg. That could be a fungi or something growing on the plant. And so I can identify a lot of different things. But that's the first thing is identification when it comes to dealing with any type of insect. You got to know what you're dealing with because everything has a different treatment. Everybody just wants to go outside and just dump whatever on there and think it's going to fix it. And I'm like, no, you can't do that. There's certain things that work very well one thing and doesn't work at all on another thing. And so you have to know what you're dealing with. And that's the part that people don't like. And I also tell them too, like, if you see a caterpillar on there, take the caterpillar off, because until you take it off, it's going to keep feeding. And people getting over their squeamish fears of insects is another thing. But hand removal, that's like, besides exclusion, that's the next best thing. If you see something, take it off. That, I mean, can't get any more basic than that.
Doesn't get more simple than that.
Right.
But that's interesting that you recommend. So I think you brought up something that a lot of people oversee, there's oversight with, is check the undersides of the leaves for pests.
Yes.
You bring stuff home because that's where a lot of pests live. And definitely with houseplant stuff too, that's where most of the pests are living. And a lot of the times we don't take the time to really flip the leaf upside down. So we miss those eggs or larvae. And then by the time everything hatches and takes over, especially with spider mites, like it's too late once the spider mites have hatched and kind of wreaked havoc on whatever indoor plant you have. Another question I just wanted to follow up. So what's your opinion on neem oil? Because I feel like some people say that like the neem oil kind of suffocates the plant, like the oil on the leaves hurts it a little bit, but then some people swear by it. So what's your opinion on that?
Okay, so yes, neem oil can be beneficial, but it can also be detrimental to the plants. And that's the problem people are having this year that are new, is they're overusing it and they're not using it correctly. So you have to dilute the neem oil in like a solution. And that's why I said, you know, I recommend the neem oil castile soap water mixture. You put
in equal parts, water, castile soap, and neem.
I'll have to give you the actual formula.
Okay.
I don't want to say the wrong thing.
Yeah. If you give it to me, yes, we can keep it in the show notes so people can refer back to it.
Okay. Yes. But it's like a certain amount of neem oil, certain amount of castile soap to per gallon of water.
Got it. Okay.
Yes. And so what happens is that people, since they're new to this, I warned them for like trying and things, but they overdo stuff. Like they're spraying the plant every day. You don't have to spray the plant every day, number one. Number two, why are you spraying the plant? Do you even see anything on there? Because a lot of times there's nothing even there yet and they're already spraying the plant. And yeah, they're doing more damage than good, because you have to think about the plant too. It carries out photosynthesis through those leaves and at night opens the stomata and all that. And if you have all this oil, it can't do what it needs to do because that oil is gumming up their stomata and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Then also, you have to look at what are you trying to control. Neem oil doesn't work on everything. Caterpillars are one. Like, you can put as much neem oil on there, and most caterpillars can overcome those chemical properties of the neem oil. So if you're dealing with a caterpillar, I usually recommend people get, it's a bacteria called BT bacteria. It's called Bacillus thuringiensis, and it specifically targets caterpillars. And again, you mix that up with water, and I can send you a link of the brands that I recommend people purchase.
Perfect.
But basically, you mix that up and you spread it on the plants, and it gives the caterpillar a bacterial infection. So within 24 to 48 hours, it will stop feeding. But up until that point of them actually consuming it, they're still feeding on the leaves. So that's why I say if you find certain insects and you're still going to treat, you still want to remove them because they will be feeding on there still.
Where do you put them once you remove them? Just on the ground?
No, because sometimes they'll crawl back up.
They'll crawl back.
I usually feed them to my chickens.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, and some people, they will relocate them to another plant that they specifically made for insects. It totally depends on what you are comfortable with doing.
Mm-hmm.
Some people kill them. Some people relocate them. Some people just spray the BT and just leave them on there and then just let it take its course on them.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just saying, letting you know that until the BT takes hold and it gets inside their digestive tracts and things like that, they're going to keep feeding. And
right,
it could be 24 to 48 hours before it takes effect. But it's things like that. When it comes to like leaf beetles, the neem oil is effective if you can actually spray it on the actual insect and it covers up their spiracles. So insects breathe through spiracles on the side of their abdomen. They don't breathe like us through a nose on their face.
Mm-hmm.
They have these spiracles on the side of their abdomen. And what happens is with the neem oil and those bubbles from the castile soap, it plugs up their spiracles and it actually suffocates them. But if you're dealing with an insect, like say a flying insect or a hopping insect, the minute you spray it on there, they're gone. Like they're going to hop off. And then when they sense that danger is no longer there, they're going to come back.
Mm.
So neem oil is effective on things like little nymphs and things that live on the plants that are the insects, the baby stage of certain insects, like true bugs, they have nymphs. So anything like stink bugs and things, their nymphs will live on there and they can't fly away. So if you spray that on them, 9 times out of 10, it's going to be effective on them. Also, if you spray it on certain eggs, the outer covering of the eggs, that oil can penetrate and actually kill developing larvae or nymph that's inside of there. But that's not always the case. Some insects, their eggs have outer shells that do not get dissolved by their oil. So you have to know what you're dealing with before you just go and start spraying random things on there, because you're not doing yourself any justice if you're spraying something on there that's not going to help you.
Got it.
Yes. So when it comes to neem oil, it can be beneficial, but it can also be damaging.
Okay.
And so people need to know that.
So speaking of knowing the right move for the right pest, you and I had kind of gone back and forth, and I pulled some listeners and got a list of like the most common garden bugs that people struggle with in their garden. So I thought we would go down the list and you could kind of share, what does it look like? Maybe what does the bug look like? How do we identify it? And then how do we treat it? Or even when to treat it, like maybe when we leave it on and leave it off. So the list we've got is aphids, caterpillars, leaf beetles, leaf miners, ants and wasps, and thrips.
Okay.
So why don't we start up with aphids? Because I think a lot of people struggle with those.
Yes. So aphids and ants are going to go together. We can talk about aphids ants together.
Okay.
So aphids, they are actual true bugs. So I have to explain this to people. So there's bugs, but everybody calls insects bugs. So bugs are all insects, but not all insects are bugs.
Okay, got it.
There's an order called Hemiptera, and these are what are called the true bugs. So if you're referring to aphids, if you're referring to stink bugs, kissing bugs, assassin bugs, you're correct when you call them bugs. Now, if you're talking about like a lady beetle and you call it a lady bug, technically you're incorrect because it's an actual beetle. But aphids, so yes, they are bugs. The way you deal with them is that neem oil cast out soap water solution that you have would work very well on them, because for the most part, they're not going to fly away. Now, they do have a life stage, and I have a whole video about aphids and how to control them on brassica plants, but it'll apply to all plants in actuality.
Oh, great. We'll link to it in the show notes.
Yes.
People want to take a deeper dive.
Yes. So they have a weird reproductive cycle. In the spring, you have females emerge and they will actually give birth to live aphids, and they're actually clones of herself. So she made it, a male and a female made it back in the fall. They lay eggs, those eggs overwinter, and what we get in the spring is what was the result of that mating in the fall. So they're all going to emerge as females, and then these females, they come out, and within like 14 days, they're able to reproduce. So then they start reproducing and they lay live young that are actual clones of themselves. And then those live young, you know, another few days, they'll be able to reproduce. And so that's how you get so many aphids on the plant in such a short period of time, because they have this fast reproductive rate, and then they're just cloning themselves, and they're coming out like alive. They're not being laid as eggs. The eggs actually hatch inside the female, and then she just lays these live young. So aphids, they have piercing sucking mouth parts, which means they're actually sucking plant sap out of the stem. So certain things that you would do for like a chewing insect, like a caterpillar or like a beetle, it doesn't apply to them because they have this mouth part that's like a needle, and it just sticks straight down into the plant. And so they're not chewing the surface. They're sucking the sap out of that plant. So when you find them on your plant, what you're going to want to do is cover them with something so you smother them. And then if you're not squeamish, you want to actually remove them from the plant. Like you can take a cloth and wipe the plant off. Now, the reason I say ants and aphids go together is because ants actually farm aphids. They look at them as like little cows. And the reason is that aphids, when they're feeding, engorge themselves so much, they release what is called honeydew. And it's sweet, sugary water that they excrete from their abdomen. It's pretty much they use the bathroom. But the ants like that sweet honeydew. And so the ants will find these aphids, and they will actually protect the aphids, and they will bring the aphids to plants. They will move them around so that they can keep creating this honeydew that the ants love. And so a lot of times aphids are brought to plants by ants.
Wow.
Now, the ants themselves are not damaging a plant, but inadvertently causing damage to the plant because they're bringing these aphids to there. So if you get the aphids under control, the ants will go away because there's no reason for them to be there now. Ants do not normally feed unless they're like leaf cutter ants and things, which we don't really have those here in the United States. But they don't feed on plants, but they will bring aphids.
So ants are normally a response to aphids or something else being present. That's interesting because I have a lime tree that we just put outdoors and it's covered in ants, but it's because my lime tree has had scale for years. And at first we saw the ants climbing all over it and we were like, oh, we're so excited. The ants are going to eat the scale. And then we Googled it and it said, no, the ants are attracted to the scales. It's not honeydew, right? Whatever the sticky substance it leaves behind. So it's that we got to get rid of the scale and then the ants will go away. That's very interesting.
Exactly.
And what do aphids look like to the eye? So how would I know that a plant had an aphid on it?
So they're tiny little insects. They can be a variety of colors depending on what species is present. They could be like a yellowish color. Some are green, some are red, brown, like a blackish color. There's hundreds of different types of aphids. And some aphids are host specific, like they only feed on certain plants. And then some of them are generalists. They feed on a number of different plants. But if you see ants on a plant and a lot of ants on a plant, that's what you're going to want to start looking for. These little tiny insects.
Or the honeydew. Probably see the sticky honeydew as well.
Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't, because sometimes the ants are very efficient at drinking it up before it sticks to the plant. But when we talk about the scales are another true bug. They fall under that Hemiptera order. And again, they are sap suckers. They suck the sac out of the plants and then they excrete that honeydew, and that's why those ants are there. Now, another problem that comes along with the honeydew and that stickiness is that you can get what mildew is that? Is it powdery mildew? There's a fungi that grows on that sugary substance that on the leaves. Okay. And so you have that. No, I think it's downy mildew. I forget which fungi it is, but when you have a lot of aphids or a lot of insects that are excreting honeydew, which a lot of these hemipterans do that feed on plants, they create a ideal environment for fungi to grow on leaves. And so you have to be mindful of that as well. Mm. But the ants, so if you get control of whatever insects they're farming, then they'll eventually go away. Now, there are some ants, like fire ants and things, that they don't feed on plants, but they can be a nuisance because they sting. They
to my
bite
ankles, they can be a nuisance.
Yes. I know a lot of people in the South are dealing with that now. Like they set up a raised bed or even a flower pot and the fire ants have made that to their part of their nest. So they're having to deal with fire ants and things like that. So that's a whole nother area. It's hard trying to control fire ants. You have to use things like baits that you lay out and the workers will take it back to the nest and then feed it to the other workers. And eventually it'll work through the whole colony, but it takes time to control. Their colonies can be like millions of ants and it could stretch a whole yard and things. And so where you find the mounds, that's not even the entrance of the actual colony on a fire ant. That's where they, store eggs and things like that. The entrance could be like a ways down. And so people need to, when it comes to fire ants, that's a whole nother area that everybody doesn't have to deal with those. But everybody in the South is dealing with them, but we don't have them up here in Ohio because we get the winter and things like that. So, yeah. But if you find ants on your plants, most likely you have aphids or some other sap-sucking insect that's producing honeydew. Now, there are some plants that have what are called nectar fularies on them. One plant in particular that I grew was the loofah sponges. So on the leaves, there are these little bitty tiny spots that plant will actually release nectar and it will attract ants and the ants will actually protect the plant and they will keep other insects from attacking that plant. I never had any problems with insects on those plants because those ants will protect it. Almost to the point they wouldn't even allow the bees to come and pollinate the flowers. So there's certain plants. So you have to know what plant you're dealing with. So I always tell people when they're starting a garden or whatever, you need to research whatever you're trying to grow. And you need to research the plant as well as what may feed on this plant or what problems this plant may encounter in the environment that you're in and things and go from there. But yeah, certain plants, they have those nectar fularies that will actually attract ants and they use those ants to help protect them. So that's that too.
Wow. Okay. Oof. That's so much. But it's very interesting to understand the symbiosis. Is that a word? But the friendship or the enemies that these different bugs make with each other. That's very interesting.
thank you, Espoma Organics, for sponsoring today's episode. Espoma Organics is a family-owned and operated company dedicating to making safe indoor and outdoor gardening products for people, pets, and the planet. It's gardening season, plant friends. It is in full swing. And for your many garden projects and problems, Espoma Organics has the solution for you, from their amazing organic potting mixes to their fertilizers to their pest control sprays. Espoma has eco-friendly organic products to help you and your garden thrive. I hope you caught the video on my YouTube channel where we planted up my mom's tomato patch with Espoma Biotone Starter, and we'll be following up with Tomato Tone throughout the season. But since this episode is all about garden pests and insects, I wanted to let you know that Espoma has an entire line of organic insect and pest control sprays to make your life easier if you're not interested in making your own concoctions like we discuss in the episode. They have a neem oil spray, insect soap sprays, weed killer, and even snug and snail bait. Billy and I personally use their insect soap and their insect control sprays on our indoor plants that has been really helpful. And after this conversation with Nadia, I'm really excited to have the Espoma Neem Oil 3-in-1 fungicide, miticide, and insecticide in my garden quarter ready for defense whenever the pests descend. To learn more about all of the amazing products that Espoma Organic has to offer us, visit espoma.com to see where your local Espoma dealers are, or you can click the link in the show notes to my Bloom and Grow Espoma Amazon storefront filled with my favorite Espoma products and order online. I hope your gardens are thriving and blooming and growing in this gardening season, and that Espoma is helping you. You hear that slurping, plant friends? That is me on my dregs of my daily dose of greens, courtesy of today's sponsor, Equilibria. Equilibria is a woman-owned wellness brand with unique science-backed products that help bring your mind and body back into harmony. I always have loved green juice and greens powders. Obviously, I love plants. I love growing plants. I love eating plants. Plants are good for you. And I have tried most greens powders brands on the market, honestly, at this point. I have to say, I'm really loving the Equilibria Daily Nutri-Greens. I might argue it's probably one of the best tasting greens powders I've ever had, and that says a lot because I've tried most of them. The Equilibria Daily Nutri-Greens contains an immune antioxidant and detox blend, along with prebiotics, probiotics, and over 35 fruits and veggies. There's no way I'm eating 35 fruits and vegetables throughout the day, but I love that I'm getting little doses and the micronutrients that are in each of the different veggies and fruits, right? Plus, they're certified organic, which I love. A lot of the competitors are not. I just mix one scoop of the greens powder into my water every day, and I'm shocked at how delicious this powder tastes. It's kind of like apple juice. I started back on the greens powder bandwagon because this spring, in this like season of rejuvenation, I'm kind of rejuvenating, doing an overhaul of my health. I've returned to my workout routine. I'm getting in more sleep. I've recommitted to my morning practice, and I've made this Equilibria Nutri-Greens part of that morning practice, drinking the powder in water in the morning. Plus, I love a female-founded company, right? Don't we all? If you want to try this greens powder, Equilibria is hooking you up with 15% off. Head to myeq.com and use code BLOOM for 15% off Equilibria's daily Nutri-Greens and so many other different products on their website. That's myeq.com and use code BLOOM at checkout for 15% off site-wide today. Okay, back to the show. So yes. What about another bug that people either love because they think are really cute or hate because they think are really creepy? Caterpillars, and what, you know, yes, they can do to leaves and to our gardens.
Yes. So caterpillars, I kind of touched on them a second ago, but yeah, so caterpillars are the larva of butterflies and moths. Mm-hmm. Most caterpillars are, like I was saying, host specific, which means that they have a certain plant that they feed on. And if that plant is not present, then those caterpillars can't, you know, grow, pupate, and then turn into a butterfly or a moth. One great example is the monarch. They feed on milkweed. And so you can't get them to feed on anything else. That's their host plant. Now, there are some other caterpillars that are generalists, which means they feed on a number of different plants. And so knowing that, and you're growing certain things that might be a plant that they would feed on, either have to create barriers in the beginning when you first set your garden up. So putting up things like insect netting to keep the butterflies and moths out, mm-hmm, would be your first line of defense. Now, if you didn't do that and you're getting attacked by caterpillars, then I recommend people do first hand removal. So looking at both sides of the leaves, usually what happens, butterflies and moths, they will lay their eggs on the underside of leaves. The caterpillars will hatch. They'll be very tiny at that point. So they're going to feed on the bottom side of the leaf. And then as they get bigger, that's when they start doing the most damage, because then they're just consuming the whole leaf. And then they'll consume the whole leaf, and then they'll make their way to the top of the leaf, like on the other side, because they're so big now. But for the most part, when they first start out, they'll do what is called skeletonizing the leaf, where they're just feeding on the surface because their mouth is very tiny and they're not really able to go all the way through the leaf. But when they get bigger, that's when they start doing all that damage. So if you see them, even in that tiny stage, depending on the caterpillar, some are very, very tiny and some are, you know, can see them when they first hatch, whatever. But once you identify the caterpillars, hand removal is the first thing. And then you want to spray that plant with that BT bacteria I was talking about.
Okay.
And you mix that, I think it's like a teaspoon or 2 teaspoons of the BT bacteria to 1 gallon of water. You mix it up, and I'll give you the link to that video as well, explaining how to set up the sprayers and things like that. And so the first line of defense is barriers, using insect netting, covering your plants, keeping the butterflies and moths out. Also, crop rotation. People don't think about that when they're especially growing in containers, that you still need to rotate out crops, because what happens is that year before, if you were dealing with some particular insect or arthropod, 9 times out of 10, they've laid eggs and either the eggs have hatched and the adults, they will go and overwinter in the soil, or a caterpillar will go and pupate and live in that soil until spring comes around, and then they'll emerge and then go about mating and things, or they'll lay eggs in the soil and then the eggs will hatch, and then you'll have these adults emerge and things like out of there, or you'll have larvae emerge and then they'll eventually turn to adults. So if you're not rotating your crops and you're growing the same thing over and over and over again, and those things are present, they're just going to keep feeding because you're setting up that environment for them. So say you had problems with cabbage worms this year, it'd probably be wise that you don't plant some type of brassica plant in that same pot, because most likely if you were having problems with cabbage worms and flea beetles, they've probably laid eggs inside that soil, or you have overwintering caterpillar pupa in the soil. And so what's going to happen when they emerge as adults, you just gave them their meal again, so then they can just go out and keep so doing that same life cycle.
So if you put strawberries there, which is not a brassica, then those larvae or pupils are going to hatch. Those worms will grow, but since they're not going to feed on that, they'll go elsewhere.
It'll go elsewhere, or they'll just die out if they can't find their host plant. Yes. So that's why you do crop rotation.
Okay. Super interesting.
Yes.
Okay. So caterpillars also, it's important to look on the underside of the leaves. And first defense, take them off with your hands. Second defense, spray them down with the BT bacteria. And you'll give all that information. We'll keep it in the show notes for people.
Yes. Yes.
Now let's talk about leaf beetles. Let's talk beetles. I feel like are kind of scary for people. So what do we need to know about beetles in general?
Okay. So there's all different types of beetles. Some of them are predators. Some of them are actually beneficial to you. Okay. They'll feed on other insects. Some of them are what we deem as pests because they will feed on your plants. Some of them, their larvae will feed on the roots of your plants. So you have to know what beetle you're dealing with. The leaf beetles you're going to deal with are flea beetles, Japanese beetles. Those are the most common ones I can think of right now.
Yeah.
So what you're going to do for those, especially with Japanese beetles, if you see them and you can catch them because they can't fly, is to remove them. And then you want to sprinkle diatomaceous earth on your plants. Same thing with flea beetles. Flea beetles are these little tiny black beetles, and I absolutely despise them little things because they do so much damage, even though they're so small. Mm-hmm. But they will destroy brassica plant leaves. And so what you want to do, because they're so small, and the reason they're called flea beetles is because they jump like fleas would, so they're hard to catch. You want to sprinkle diatomaceous earth on your plants. So
what is that?
It's like a fine powder, and it has diatoms in there. So diatoms are these little creatures that you would find like in the ocean and things, fossilized. And they put them into a powder, and what happens is it'll actually cut insects and things because they don't have the same body makeup as we do. So it can be very irritating to them. And if it's like a leaf beetle, they don't want to eat diatomaceous earth. So it will stop them from feeding on the leaves.
Okay.
It can be bad for other insects as well. So I kind of want you to use this as a last resort. Mm-hmm. If you're going to plant something and you know you're going to have to deal with flea beetles because you've had them in the area before, number one, you want to do the crop rotation. If you can't do the crop rotation and say it's a container, you probably want to change out that soil and start over, because they're most likely in that soil. And so if you're going to try to grow collards again or whatever plant that there's their host plant, you're going to deal with them again because they're in that soil and they overwintered in there. But if you didn't have a problem with flea beetles, or this is your first time ever growing anything, using that insect netting will help you 100%, because it'll prevent them from actually getting access to the plants. But if you didn't do that, you're going to have to come in and be very aggressive with the diatomaceous earth and just try to keep it concentrated on that one or that group of plants that you're trying to treat, so you're not affecting other insects as well. Because like I said, it can be irritating. It can cut them up and things like that. If they crawl through it, it can cut up a number of insects. It's not just the flea beetles. It can also be kind of harmful too for things like honeybees and things if they get caught up in there.
So with the nets that you were saying, so how do those work? They're like netting, like cages that you put on top of a plant?
So you can buy on a roll and you can create like a little canopy over your plants. And what you're just trying to do is create a barrier to keep the insects from getting to it. So,
and can you water them through it? Like if I had to water it with a watering can or something?
Yes, you can water through it and rain will go right through it and everything. It just prevents insects and certain animals from accessing the plants. It has really tiny holes. It'll still allow sunlight through. It'll allow water through, but it'll prevent things like flea beetles and butterflies and anything that's going to try to feed on your plants. It'll prevent them from accessing it, but it also prevents pollinators too. So if you're growing a plant that's going to require pollination, eventually either you're going to have to remove that barrier or you're going to have to hand pollinate.
Okay.
Because if you don't, you're not going to get the fruit that you seek because there's no pollinators coming in. And a lot of times too, when you set those barriers up, if you study the plant and you study the insect that you're trying to avoid, putting that barrier up will help you actually control them, because sometimes you can wait and plant things a little bit later to where certain insects are not going to be in high populations because you moved outside of their mating time where they need those plant access to those plants and things. So one thing that we had to deal with here, and I don't know exactly where you are, but we had to deal with squash vine borers. And these are these insects that it's a moth that looks kind of like a bee, but they look for squash plants to lay their eggs on, and their larvae actually burrow into your squash plants, and they can kill your whole plant because the larvae will burrow down into the stem and it'll just eat away at the inside of the stem till it kills the plant.
Well, that's not very nice.
Not at all. But what attracts them, and they're very active about this time of year from late June to early July. This is when they're out mating and the females are out laying eggs. But what attracts them is the yellow flowers on the squash plants. They're attracted to that yellow. So if you could set up like yellow sticky traps to trick them, the adults will get stuck on the traps. And if you had those barriers up, it'll keep the adults from accessing the plants so they can lay their eggs on there. Now, once they have laid their eggs on, it's really hard to control that caterpillar once it has burrowed into there. There's some things you can do, like cut them out and all this and mend the plant up. But this is one of those insects that I'm really trying to do a research project on and figure out how we can prevent them from annihilating people's squash plants, because their damage is that detrimental that it just wiped the whole plant out. You'll have this vibrant plant, and then as soon as that caterpillar gets big enough, it'll just eat the inside of that.
Right.
And then the saps and things can't go up from the roots and things, and the plant just dies. But to prevent them is using those barriers, creating those sticky traps that are yellow that attract the adults to that, that will control them. So that's another caterpillar. The BT would be effective if it was sprayed on the outside of the plant before that caterpillar actually burrowed into there. But you have to know exactly when the BT needs to be on there, and you have to know. So it's like, it's a lot you will have to know to prevent that from happening.
Got it.
But the BT would be effective against them before they actually burrowed into the plant. Once they're in there, the BT really can't get to them because right, they're in the plant.
Inside the stem. Yeah. Infiltrators. Gosh. Yes. Okay, so that's for that type of caterpillar or moth. But for the leaf beetles that we were talking about, just to recap, you said use barriers and then use, as a last resort, the diatomaceous earth.
Yes. if you have to use a diatomaceous earth, just try to keep it focused on the plants that you're trying to treat. And what happens if it rains or something, you're going to have to reapply it. When I had to deal with a flea beetle infestation that I had on some collard plants, I had about 90 collard plants and they all end up with flea beetles. Some of them had more than others, but they were just damaging all the plants. So I had to keep applying it because we had a lot of rain that year. It took about 2 weeks before I got them under control. So I had to keep that layer of diatomaceous earth on there. So it just made it where they did not want to come on those plants anymore. And then after that, they never came back. It was like, even though I didn't have diatomaceous earth on there, they never came back.
You trained them.
Yes.
Interesting. Now, what about leaf miners, which we had someone write in, which is those leaf miners that make that like squiggly weird line all over your leaves? How do we eradicate those guys?
So leaf miners, they can be a number of different insects. It could be a caterpillar. It could also be a fly larva. It's a particular fly that the maggot actually feeds on leaves. And I think there's also a mite that can be a leaf miner.
Okay.
So knowing that, the best method, because they're actually under the surface of the leaf and they're mining through it, they're not on the outs. They're in the middle of the leaf and they're mining through it. So a lot of things that you spray on there will not get to them. So the best thing to do if you see a leaf miner leaf that has that damage on it is to actually remove that leaf so that insect, whatever it is burrowing through there, cannot have access to it. Yeah, it can't spread to another one. Or if you've dealt with leaf miners in the past, maybe covering those plants like early in the season when the adults are out looking for those particular plants to lay their eggs on will prevent them from doing that. But the best thing to do is to just remove that leaf that has that damage so that they can't spread to another one.
Okay. And is there a percentage of leaves? Say I have a plant with 10 leaves and I've noticed 3 of the leaves have that leaf miner squiggly line damage. Is there like a percentage of the plant that I should like call it quits with? Or should I just obviously remove those 3 leaves like you said? But is there a percentage that like, because obviously the plant needs the leaves to photosynthesize. So any guidelines there?
So if it's a new plant and it only has a few leaves, in all actuality, the leaf miner, it's more of an aesthetic thing. They're not really going to probably kill the plant.
Oh, okay. So the leaf can still photosynthesize and feed the plant.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So if it's a young plant and doesn't have a lot of leaves, I would just leave the leaf there. But if it's a pretty big plant, it seems to be healthy, doesn't have any other attacks going on, just taking that leaf away, it'll be okay. But usually like new plants that just sprouted and they only have like a few primary leaves, you probably just want to leave those there so they can carry out the photosynthesis because they're still kind of young and they need as much leaf coverage as possible. Now, if the leaf miners are out of control, then if it's a plant that's just like infested with them, then you might want to just remove that whole plant. But yeah, you have to kind of gauge it yourself. Like, is this plant that I just planted and it's only like a month old? Do I want to remove this leaf? No. But does this plant have like every leaf covered with a leaf miner and it's a new plant that I have like 30 other ones growing? Mm-hmm. Can I go without this plant? So you have to decide like what's going to be the best method for you.
Right.
Depending on what you have. Yes.
Taking the leaf off to avoid the spread versus keeping the leaf to help the plant.
Yes.
Okay, got it.
Or taking out that whole plant so that it prevents the other ones from getting infected.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, what about wasps and thrips? Those are our last two we were going to talk about.
Okay, so wasps are actually beneficial.
Okay.
Wasps are predatory. They actually feed on a lot of soft body insects, and caterpillars are their top choice.
Okay.
When you see wasps in your garden and you see them crawling on the plants, they're looking for caterpillars.
Okay.
Yes. So you'll see them crawl on the stem. You'll still go on the underside of the leaf. They know where to look for caterpillars. So if you see wasps, that probably means you have caterpillars. So they can be a first indicator that you have a caterpillar problem. If you're seeing them crawling on your plants, and just do what the wasp does. You'll see them crawl on the stem. So you need to look at the stem. Mm-hmm. You look at the underside, you'll see them go under the underside, and then you'll actually see them where they'll catch them and they'll actually start to chew them up. So the actual adult wasps do not feed on the caterpillar flesh, but they will feed on the juices that are inside the hemolymph that's inside the caterpillar. That's what their blood is called. So what they do is they'll chew them up and they'll suck out some of those juices, and then they take the meat and they actually take them back to their colony and they feed it to the larva. Now the larva are actually meat eaters, so they'll eat those actual caterpillars.
Wow.
There are some other wasps that eat other insects. Some of them are other arthropods. There's certain wasps that use spiders as a food for their young. So they'll stun a spider. A lot of times wolf spiders here in Ohio are prey to these particular types of wasps, and they'll take them back to their nest and they'll lay the eggs on the spider, and then the larva will feed on that spider, and then, you know, they'll pupate and then turn into adult wasps. Then there's other wasps called parasitoid wasps, where they will actually lay eggs on caterpillars or other insects. They'll lay eggs on the surface, or they will lay eggs underneath the skin of a caterpillar or insect. The eggs will hatch, larvae will come out, and they will actually feed on that particular insect they were laid on. And then they will, when they're about to pupate, they'll erupt out and they'll make these little white cocoons, and they will be in the cocoons, and them erupting out of there will actually kill that caterpillar or whatever insect they were in. And then they'll emerge out of those cocoons and they'll start the whole cycle over again. So wasps are beneficial. Now there is one particular hymenopteran that is called a sawfly. It looks like a wasp and it lays eggs, and their larvae look like caterpillars. The only way you would know the difference is you have to count the prolegs.
Oh, okay. Which we probably wouldn't be able to count up close in the garden.
Depending on what sawfly is present, but their larvae will actually feed on leaves. They'll defoliate like a caterpillar would. So there is one particular type of wasp sawfly, that whole order, or not order, but whole family of sawflies. There's different ones, but they feed on leaves. So their larvae do feed on leaves, so they can cause damage. But things like BT would not be effective against them because they're not caterpillars. They're wasp larvae. So you would just have to know what you're dealing with. There's one particular sawfly that actually feeds on like pine trees. Mm-hmm. So if you see something that on a pine tree that looks like a caterpillar, it's probably not a caterpillar. It's probably a sawfly larva. And if there's a large number of them, they can really do a lot of damage to a pine tree. So you just have to know what you're looking at. That's why I always say you have to know, you have to identify what you're looking at so you know how to control that.
Do you have a suggestion for like insect bug identification book to get? Is there like a Bible for identification that you could suggest people get?
I recommend the Peterson Field Guides. It's called Insects. It's called Peterson Field Guides, and it's by Donald J. Bohr and Richard E. White.
Oh, yeah. Field Guide to Insects. There's Field yes. Guide to Everything. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yes.
And so it gives you black and white pictures, and it shows you like structures and things. And then you can go from there, like deciding like what order it may belong to. Mm-hmm. You know, there's different orders of insects. There's beetles, bees, grasshopper, all types of stuff like that. And then from there, if you look up like, maybe you can't single it out to a specific insect, but if you can get to an order, then you can see, like, what does this order normally feed on? Are they defoliators? Are they predators or whatever? Then you can go from there deciding, like, what treatments. And then if you really want to know exactly what it is, like I say, you can find an entomologist. There's some websites. I think it's, what is that one thing on the internet that people always go to, and they'll put pictures in there. The people on there, they get so many requests that they don't always get to every picture that people send them. But there's some guides online that they will actually ID if you put a picture on there. Now, if you're going to provide somebody with a picture, please make sure that it's clear and that you can get it as close as possible, especially for those little tiny insects. Because I get a lot of times when people take pictures and they're like, you see the insect? I'm like, no, all I see is a blur.
Okay. If you're going to go ask for free advice, yes. The least you could do is send a clear photo.
Yes, a clear photo. If it's a large insect, try to get the whole insect. Mm-hmm. But I had people where they just zoom in on a spot on the insect. I'm like, I need to know like more than that, that okay. spot. Yes. And so things like that. Or if you get a video too, video will help, a clear video. Cause I've got videos where people's hands are shaking because they're terrified of what they're videoing and things like. So yes, if you're going to send a video, I need a video where I can really focus in on the insect. But a picture is better. A clear picture is probably ideal.
Okay.
And then tell me what plant you found it on as well, because that will help identify, cause there's some things that look similar. And they may be actually predators versus the actual leaf feeding insect or whatever. So I need to know if you found it on the plant or where you actually found it, so that that can help identify it. And also what region you live in, because there are certain things that only live in certain places. And if it's found in a certain place, it could be that it's an invasive species now. So yeah.
I think that's the biggest takeaway for me, is that there are different plants that are different hosts for each bug. So understanding the plant that is the host. So I've been talking your ear off. We're already at 1.5 hours into this conversation. So I'll just ask you 2 more questions. So one, you know, you brought up with the wasps, predatory insects. Do you suggest releasing ladybugs in your garden or lacewings, or getting the larva of predatory insects that might help once you've identified the bug and know what insect might prey on it? Do you think that is ever helpful?
Yes and no. So lady beetles, no, because what happens with the lady beetles is that they are actually harvested, a lot of them, from the wild. And they're harvested when they're in hibernation. And so as soon as you release them outside into your gardens, most of the time they just fly away.
Right.
Because they were not even in mating, eating mode. They were asleep. And then now you've awakened them and they don't know what to do. So the first instinct is to fly away. Some people will put little cages and things around there. The things with lady beetles, if you don't actually have a huge infestation, you know, they'll feed for a little while, but once they run out of aphids or things to eat, they're going to go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they were able to stay there long enough and lay eggs and stuff, then their larva will be there and their larva will feed on those things as well. But you also have to know what a lady beetle larva look like, because a lot of times people, they mistake lady beetle larva for something else and they end up killing them. So I have pictures of what those look like, if people want to know what they look like, so they're not actually going out killing lady beetle larvae.
Okay.
But the thing with lady beetles is that if you set up the environment, 9 times out of 10, like, they're going to have places to hide, lay their eggs. And then if you have aphid problems, they usually come find them. Like, you don't have to do things to attract them. They can smell food, and so they will come in. But if you have a biodiverse environment, 9 times out of 10, they're going to move right in anyway. I would suggest buying lady beetles and releasing them, because it's just a waste of money to have them fly away.
Okay.
And then people were doing that, like, they were spending like $40 every 2 weeks because they would fly away. I'm like, don't you realize they're just taking your money, because they're not staying there. And then when it comes to lace wings and stuff, the same thing. Like, they'll stay there for a little while, but if the food resources become depleted, they're going to go somewhere else. The best thing to do is to set up an environment that's inviting for them. So when you're selecting your plants, just having diversity. Lady beetles, a lot of them actually feed on pollen and nectar and things as well. They don't just feed on insects. So that's why I say you have to research the insects and things that you're wanting to either bring in or keep out to know what they want. Lace wings, and what was the other one you had asked about?
I had just primarily said lacewing and lady beetles, because it's interesting. I did a while back with Summer Rain Oaks a conversation on pest control indoors, and she is a huge believer in using lacewings and ladybugs indoors, but that's because they don't fly away. When you're using them inside, like, if you release them on your plants, they're pretty much staying in your plants because you're indoors, if, you know, your doors and windows aren't open. But it makes total sense that in your garden, which is outdoors, that idea isn't going to work. That plan isn't going to work the same.
Yes.
Yeah, that's super interesting. So before we go, we've talked a lot about biodiversity in our gardens, and you are so committed to bringing more diversity to the agriculture workforce and to the gardening space. So I'd love to hear just a little bit more about the work that you're doing with Agra Academy and how people could support you in that work or get involved if they were interested, and just support you in the amazing work that you're doing in Ohio.
Okay, so this year we were, because of COVID-19, Agri Academy actually partnered with an organization here called the Grailville, and they allowed us to use 10 acres of their certified organic land. And so what we're going to do is we receive some funding to start it's called Farming is Essential, where we're actually going to grow produce and sell it to people here in the community to, you know, combat our food supply chain thing that's being depleted because of COVID-19. But we're also going to offer classes and things to certain populations of people to get them more involved with the whole agriculture industry, farming, learning about small scale local farming, and learning about different things that they can do. They don't necessarily have to be out in a field. They can be growing in their yards or growing indoors and things like that. So I have a whole campaign. We did receive a grant from the United Way to go towards this project, but the project still, we still need more funding, and we're trying to buy a new tractor. And so I have our website and stuff where you can go in there if you'd like to donate. It's Agricademy, and that's agricademy.org/farming. And it'll tell you about the project that we're doing. Also, we're going to buy a old tractor. The Grailville had one that they're actually selling. And so we're going to purchase that. But we need a brand new one because I don't know how long that old one's going to last. and so I would hate to get in the middle of this. And then my little urban farm, I could use one of those push behind tillers and things. But 10 acres is a different ball game.
Yeah. And so are you setting up, once you till and grow this land, you're setting up a CSA for local community members? Are you targeting BIPOC individuals or communities? How are you kind of going about figuring out the communities that you're going to serve?
So for the United Way, that particular funding was for getting Black people more involved in farming, mm-hmm. in agriculture.
Okay.
So that part of that particular grant is going to go towards that particular project. But the 10 acres in all, like, that's just one little portion of it. Growing the other stuff is going to be for everybody that wants to purchase organically grown produce. And then we'll have a whole nother section of where people can take classes and learn about small scale agriculture. So
very cool.
There's a couple of projects going on the 10 acres, but the United Way one is the one that we're kicking off first. But also at the same time, we're kicking off the whole growing the produce for this region and things like that. And just showing like local agriculture, local farming can change a whole community's dynamics if you're doing it right. And so we're going to show them how to go about creating business plans and different agricultural entrepreneurship type ventures that they can get into, and it doesn't cost a lot of money. Or if it does, we're going to show them how the resources they can pursue, like grants and things from the government or from local organizations, and how to go about even applying for those and things like that. So that's the goal.
That's amazing. And where can everyone find you? I mean, you have so much free educational resources for anyone, especially with the YouTube, like all of the different lectures you give on YouTube and your Instagram. So where can we find you and follow you?
So on Instagram, you can find me under Urban Farm Sista, and Sista is Sista. I'm also under Urban Farm Sista on Facebook. I have a Facebook page. YouTube is Urban Farm Sista again, and Twitter. And then I have pages and websites for the different organizations and things that in my businesses that I have. But all that information is on the Urban Farm Sista page. So you can just visit there, and then you can click on those links and things to get to the other pages.
And we will link to everything in the show notes as well, so people can make sure that they go give you a follow and a subscribe.
Yes. And I appreciate that. Yes, definitely. But yes, my YouTube, every week, try to do some type of discussion on Sundays where I talk about something that may have gone on during the week. So when COVID-19 came along, before I was, you know, this urban farmer scientist, I used to also, after I left veterinary medicine, I worked in public health, and I was a disease investigator. And so a lot of what you saw as far as like contact tracing and things for the COVID-19, that's what I used to do. I did that for almost 5 years. So here in the county that I live in, I would prevent disease outbreaks here. And so I was educating about different things as it pertained to COVID-19 as what I used to do as far as all types of diseases, and explaining how public health goes about finding cases, testing. And so I was educating on that. So I have a lot of videos on that, but I also have a lot of videos on insects. And then as I kick off this farming venture, which is actually starting this week, because we just got our funding and all that. So now I can actually go and buy things and get started.
Very cool. Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm going to start doing a lot of farming and agricultural videos again, since that's what my time is going to be consisting of now for the next few months. is farming this 10 acres.
Oh my God. Amazing. Well, I can't wait to follow your journey and stay in touch with you and probably text you pictures of bucks that I find.
Yes. That'll be fine. Yes. You can send me pictures. Now that I'm about to kick it off, I might not be able to reply to the messages immediately like I've been able to, but I usually try to within the next day or two get you an answer to what you may be dealing with. So just keep that in mind.
Yes, we will all be patient and grateful for your free advice that you give us. So thank you, Nadia. Everybody go support Agra Academy, follow her on her accounts, and thank you for this amazing buggy insecty chat. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're so welcome. And thank you for inviting me. I really enjoy talking about insects and plants and science. That's just my life. So this is very fun.
Nerding out. I love it.
Yes.
Thank you, Nadia, for that amazingly in-depth interview. Man, it's got to go back and re-listen to that and take some notes. I'm just thankful for her time. Bloom and Grow Radio has made a donation to Agra Academy for the Food is Essential program that they're running. Nadia is such an amazing plant lady trying to do such good in her community, and we are committed to supporting her. And I hope you guys consider supporting Agra Academy and the amazing things that she's doing as well. Make sure that you follow her on her Urban Farm Sista YouTube and Instagram accounts, because she's just got so much free educational content for us. It's amazing. Thank you to our Patreon plant friends for supporting the show. You guys who show up for the show on a monthly basis, putting your dollars where your support is, it means the world to me, and I'm so thankful. If you want to support the show and maybe are not in the position to give monetarily, that is totally understandable. Plant friends, all I ask is that you share the show with someone in your life this week. Take an episode that you think a plant friend or maybe a non-plant friend could use and help bring this show to as many ears as possible. And thank you to our amazing episode sponsors, MakeSpace and Espoma Organics. If you need to make some space in your life, plant friends, I cannot encourage you to try MakeSpace more. They ship you the packing materials for free. You pack it up, they pick it up, they store it, and they deliver it right back to you. They take the struggle out of storage. And if you are interested, they're offering us $100 off their storage solution with the code SPACE, PLZ. So it's like space, please. Space, PLZ at checkout. So check out makespace.com and use the code SPACE, PLZ at checkout. And thank you, of course, as always, to our soil sponsor, Espoma Organics. For information about their amazing indoor and outdoor gardening products, visit espoma.com to find your local dealers, or click the link in the show notes to go to my Espoma Amazon storefront, where I have my favorite Espoma selections curated for you already. Plant friends, I hope that you find time to step away from your phones and engage with your plants, to look away from a screen, look towards a plant this week, plant some kindness, whatever that means to you. I've been thinking about that a lot lately. And I wish you beautifully planty weeks, whatever that looks like for you, wherever you are in the world. It is so cool to look at those downloads and see all of the different countries that this podcast reaches, and knowing that there's a little planty community across the country growing joy and growing positivity, growing kindness together. Until next time, plant friends, keep blooming and keep growing. Plant friends, thank you so much for tuning in today. If you like what you heard, make sure you are subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. And while you're making sure you're subscribed, why don't you head on over to the review section of whatever podcast player you're tuning into and leave us a review. I would greatly appreciate it. If you are interested in more fun and educational planty content, well, plant friend, I've got a whole lot for you. Subscribe to the Bloom and Grow YouTube show, which is my YouTube channel where I bring you along for my personal plant journey, as well as share informational content that pairs with our podcast episodes. Follow me at Bloom and Grow Radio on Instagram for behind the scenes sneak peeks at upcoming episodes, my daily planty lessons and thoughts, and most importantly, tune into my Instagram stories where I am constantly talking with you listeners and plant friends and polling you for content ideas, and I'm always interested in seeing what you're loving these days on Instagram. Join the Bloom and Grow mailing list and get a free download of the Molly Mansfield Keep Blooming print that she created exclusively for our community. And if you can, support Bloom and Grow Radio by becoming a plant friend on Patreon. For as little as $4 a month, you not only help me bring these planty and informative episodes to thousands of ears around the world, but you will also get the super secret planty password to our exclusive Bloom and Grow Radio Garden Club Facebook group, which is a wonderfully active group of plant friends of the Bloom and Grow Radio podcast who make up what I like to call the plantiest corner of the internet. It is a lot of fun over there. And as always, my sweet plant friends, I am here for you. If you have ideas for episode topics, guests, or if you're possibly a business interested in sponsoring the show, reach out to me because I am here to help all of you keep blooming and keep growing. Plant friends, propagate knowledge, and grow some freaking joy. That's the motto of the Growing Joy Garden Society app and platform, otherwise known as the plantiest and kindest corner of the internet. If you've been an OG listener or a longtime listener, you might also know this app and platform as the Bloom and Grow Garden Party, but with the rebrand, we've rebranded it to the Growing Joy Garden Society. No trolls allowed, kind plant friends only. And if you haven't heard about the society yet, Plant Friend, you got to join. It's my online community that you can access via iOS or Android app or on your computer that I built to connect our international community of plant friends so we can all nerd out together about plants and celebrate our passion for our beloved plant babies. We have members literally all over the world. I'm so in love with this community of sweet plant friends. I can't say enough amazing things about them. But also, there's a lot of really cool features about the app you might be interested in. There's dedicated hashtags to all sorts of different subsects of planty passions like houseplants, gardening, plant-inspired DIY projects, growing joy, plants and pets, and so many more. There's a plantrepreneur group, so if you're a planty entrepreneur and you want to connect with other planty entrepreneurs, you can join that group to connect and network. There's a plant swap section. Plus, the entire app, and this is my favorite part, is entirely searchable. So say you want to learn more about Hoya, you type the word Hoya into the search bar, and literally every post ever created about Hoya will pop up so you can click in, see what other people have been posting about Hoya and learn on your own and crowdsource hair information. It's so cool. But last but not least, it's an amazing way to support the show. Your monthly membership not only goes to sustaining the platform, but it also supports my team of editors, writers, and a community manager that help the world of Bloom and Grow keep growing. So come join us. All you got to do is go to jointhegardensociety.com and sign up for the community plan. Once again, you go to jointhegardensociety.com and click the community plan. Hot take, plant friends. There is no one right starter plant. There, I said it. And you know what? While I'm at it, there are also no real plant killers in the world. There are just people who have not figured out their right plants for their lifestyle. This is why I created the free Plant Parent Personality Test, because Plant Friend, I want you to get thriving alongside your houseplants as quickly as possible, so I made this cutie little Plant Parent Personality Quiz that's totally free for you on my website to take the guesswork out of building your plant collection effortlessly and joyfully. After speaking to thousands of members in our community, I realized that there are about five key plant parent personalities, each one with their unique set of strengths, weaknesses, and a unique set of plants that thrive under their care. For example, a mindful plant parent, someone who wants to engage with their plants daily, use them in their morning routines. If someone gifted that plant parent a succulent and they watered it every day, that succulent would die immediately. However, that drought-resistant succulent is a perfect match for a low-key plant parent, which is someone who travels, has kids, is busy, doesn't have time to engage with their plants every day. They're looking to engage with their plants more like once a week or once every couple of weeks. In addition, obviously, to understanding your light and basic plant care that we provide on this podcast, Happy Plant Parenthood is all about discovering your personality and then picking the right houseplants to go with it. It's that simple. No more stressing over your collection. So what plant parent personality type are you, plant friend? All you got to do to find out is take my free quiz on my website and let me know. You can access it at growingjoywithmaria.com/personality. After taking the test, you'll get an email with a list of plants, podcast episodes, and planty projects that I think would light you specifically up like a full spectrum grow light. So once again, that's growingjoywithmaria.com/personality for your free plant parent personality test results.